I've often said that good ideas win because they're good ideas. When you're able to lay out the information in a way that's easy to understand, easy to digest, then people can change their mind. It's not about shutting people down. It's about having open and intelligent conversation. And that's exactly what we're going to dig into today. I am joined by my friend Vijay, and he is going to explain some concept to us in a very easy to way understand. He has recently written a new book called The Bullish Case for Bitcoin, and he is going to talk about some of the biggest objections that people have to Bitcoin in a very simple, easy to understand way that I think is going to make a lot of sense. Some of the biggest objections you might have heard are actually very simple when you can understand them at a different level. So much to get into here. It's a great conversation, one that I really enjoyed. So let's go ahead and just jump right into it. Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Market Disruptor Show. And today I am joined by Vijay Boyapati, and he is a former Google software engineer and more lately known for talking about Bitcoin and the book called The Bullish Case for Bitcoin. It's actually been out for quite a while, something that I've read. I know a lot of people have, and I'm super excited to talk to you today. Thanks for joining.
Thanks, Mark. It's great to chat with you today.
Yeah. So I think the first time we met in person was at Safe Dean's dinner, and I think we got to sit across from each other at BitBlock Boom a couple years ago, and that was pretty fun. I remember you asked me specifically what my journey was into Bitcoin. And so why don't you tell us what your journey was in from being a Google software engineer, how you got in, and then what led to kind of writing this book, The Bullish Case for Bitcoin?
Yeah, I'll try and keep it a little bit compressed, but I'll start from the beginning. I'm an Australian. I was born and raised in Australia. I came to the US to do a PhD in computer science, but I ended up taking a job and ended up at a small startup, which, you know, people probably know now called Google, but it was, you know, much smaller when I joined. I worked at Google until the end of 2007, and I left because I wanted to campaign in the presidential election, the 2008 presidential election, for Ron Paul.
Wow.
And that was a great experience. I raised a lot of money. I brought hundreds of people to New Hampshire to campaign and canvass for Ron. But I actually became really disillusioned with the political process when I went through this. And I started to learn that there are much more powerful forces at work, and that grassroots campaigning really does not compare to those forces. So, for instance, Fox News decided they wouldn't let Ron in the debate, and that really had a huge impact on his ability to do well in New Hampshire. And so I was pretty cynical about the political process after that for a few years, and a little bit depressed about whether, you know, the values that I hold, which I think are American values, human freedom, the ability to pursue your happiness without other people interfering. I was a little bit depressed that it would be hard to advance those ideas through the political process. But then I came across Bitcoin in 2011, and it was really exciting because it's this new technology, which I think really promotes human freedom and promotes people's ability to keep the fruits of their labor without debasement or confiscation. And I sort of recognize that we can change the world through technology. We can change the political landscape. And I've just been so fascinated with Bitcoin for the last decade. And I had a background in Austrian economics. And I recognized when I came to Bitcoin that this is a monetary phenomena. And I've just been obsessed with this question of how does this new monetary good, which is created out of thin air, how does it have any economic value? Why does it have a price? Why do people value this thing? And so I've been obsessing over this question for a decade. And, you know, I've come across so many misconceptions about Bitcoin. In 2017, I decided I want to write an article to explain why I think Bitcoin has an economic value and provide an economic framework to think about Bitcoin. And, you know, when I wrote the article, I was hoping that it would be read by a few friends and maybe a couple of people on Wall Street. But it ended up getting read by about a million people around the world. It was translated into 20 different languages. I didn't pay for that. People just volunteered, which was so humbling that people were as excited about the article and that you know, they wanted to talk about Bitcoin and use this as a resource to share with their friends. So I wrote the article. It was received much more than I expected it would be. And then people started asking me to turn it into a book. And I thought it was, you know, the right length. It was, you know, a long form article, but it wasn't as long as a book.
Hey guys, let me just interrupt this interview real quick just to plug the show sponsor, and that is BlockFi. Now, BlockFi is doing amazing things in the Bitcoin finance space. As a matter of fact, they've cracked some really big news by bringing on the ex-CFTC chair, Chris Giancarlo, and they are one of the most transparent, most heavily regulated companies inside the United States, which gives me a lot of trust into what their services are. Now, I've recently did a video talking about how to retire off of Bitcoin. And you can do that by leveraging debt and interest against Bitcoin. And BlockFi is the number one company in the United States, or maybe in the world, to go to and use. They are leading the charge. They're paying interest on your Bitcoin if you park it with them, or you can borrow against it. Now, as I broke down in that video, you can borrow against your Bitcoin. And when you take debt against it, it's not taxable. It's not a taxable event. You can use that debt for anything that you want, including to live off of, to leverage up and buy more, or roll it into another asset. You can do something like I've done recently, like sell some real estate, put that money into Bitcoin. Now, as that Bitcoin price has risen, I'm able to borrow against it and go back and buy the same real estate or something similar. And I still own the Bitcoin and I also own the new asset as well. Lots of ways you can do this. And BlockFi is the company that I recommend. Down in the description, I have a link that you can click on. If you choose to use that link, you can earn up to $250 in Bitcoin just for using that link. So check out BlockFi now.
And so I sort of didn't do anything about that until 2020. When, you know, the pandemic happened and the government responses around the world were so crazy, in my opinion. The amount of money that was created is just staggering, trillions and trillions of dollars. And so that gave a new context in which I thought it was worth revisiting the article. And I thought there are actually some things in the article I didn't cover that are really important. I wanted to put into a book. And so I spent some of the later part of 2020 and the early part of 2021 writing the book, and I just launched it, and I'm really excited that people can get that book now. Well, I launched it as a Kickstarter, and the Kickstarter campaign has ended, but it should be in stores in about a month.
So you took the article that got the million views and was translated in all the languages, and then you've taken that and expanded on that and then turned it into a book. So you dove deeper into the different subjects and stuff.
Exactly right. I updated it because some of the things were tied to that time period in 2017 when I wrote it. And I thought there was definitely enough changes in the market that it needed to be updated. And I significantly expanded it as well. So there were a couple of things that I thought were incredibly important that I needed to discuss that I didn't in the article. So what was the historical context in which Bitcoin came about? There'd been people working in the cypherpunk community for at least a decade before Bitcoin came about, trying to create digital money, but actually having not succeeded. Many of them were skeptical something like this was possible. But so I wanted to provide that historical context. I also really wanted to tackle the question of what is Bitcoin? There was this huge debate in the Bitcoin community in 2017 about, you know, is Bitcoin a payment system? Is it kind of like PayPal, except a bit decentralized? Or is it kind of like gold? Is it more like a digital, you know, gold where you keep your savings in it? And that question was so important that it resulted in a split of the Bitcoin network, very hostile, and there was a lot of contention and people were really upset with each other. And I have a view on what Bitcoin is, and I really wanted to explain why I think Bitcoin is the way it is, why it can only be the way it is, and how that development played out. So there's a number of things like that weren't in the article that I thought were really important that I should cover.
Yeah, they sound like important things. I want to dig into some of that, but I would like to hear just about the Kickstarter piece itself, because that's kind of an interesting thing. Maybe there's people listening that have thought about writing a book, and I'm one of them. And honestly, I hadn't thought about doing a book through a Kickstarter. I've talked to a couple different publishers. I've talked to some people that assist you with self-publishing, things like that. Tell me how that process went with the Kickstarter and how it ended up.
Yeah, so I'd never written a book before. And the first thing I did was I contacted a number of people in the Bitcoin space who had written books and who I respect a lot, people like Saifedean and Jan Pritzker and Nick Bhatia, who'd written great books, in my opinion. I have them all on my shelf. And I said, what should I do here? Should I just go find a publisher or should I self-publish? And uniformly, every single one of them said self-publish. Do not use a publisher. And they gave a few reasons. One is you don't control the rights. And that dramatically reduces your flexibility of creating derivative works, whether you can do translations. There are all sorts of issues around that where it makes it harder for you to control your work. And publishers tend to be very, very slow in reacting to requests. So, I want to release an excerpt from my book, a chapter to promote the book. It can take months to get approval for that kind of thing. So that was one reason. The other reason is, you don't get paid very much if you use a publisher. They do pay you up front, but if you sell a book for $20, you're likely to get $1 or $1.50 per book, which is not a very good remuneration because the effort that goes into a book is pretty significant. You know, there's months of work where you're writing and you're sitting there alone and having writer's block and can I actually do this? I thought, okay, I'm going to self-publish. And I looked at doing that. And if you self-publish, you've got to do things yourself. You've got to do the typesetting yourself, the editing. You've got to hire an editor. There are all these costs. But the benefit is if you sell through retailers, when you self-publish, instead of $1 or $1.50, you're probably going to get maybe $5, $6 per copy, per book, which is great. But then I thought about Kickstarter. I'm like, well, maybe I can launch my book on Kickstarter. And the great thing about Kickstarter is it's this website that helps people launch projects that may not be fully finished and helps them fund those projects to get them out there. It's typically used for gadgets and electronics and even board games where people are dreaming up something they want to create and they explain to people what their vision is and people get excited and they fund it. But people also use it for books. And so I thought, okay, why don't I do this? If I do a Kickstarter and people support me on this, instead of, getting $1.50 or $5 if I self-publish, I'm selling directly. I'm going to get out of $20, I'm probably going to get about $18. So it remunerates me a lot more. And the benefit is I really want to get these ideas to as many people as possible. So I would love to have the funding to get pay for translations myself, to own the copyright for those translations, to get this to spread around the world. Because in my view, when people are presented with the reasons why Bitcoin is valuable and why it's important to the world and why it's a good idea to keep savings in Bitcoin, they really get it. They just need to have the ideas presented in a sort of logical, clear way and have some of the risks explained to them in an open, honest way. Once you do that, I find I haven't had an experience where people are like, well, I still don't believe in it. Most people I've found get it. So I'm excited to have the control over my work and to get it out there and to be compensated enough that I can fund myself translations and marketing and all of that stuff. So I think Kickstarter is a great way to do this. I encourage anyone who's thinking about writing a book to use Kickstarter. Safer Dean, his new book, he's also launched on Kickstarter. And I think this is going to be a trend, actually. I think a lot of people in this space are going to recognize this is a good way to launch a book. And it's a good way to get compensated and keep control over your own work.
So it was a success then. You were able to raise enough money up front on pre-order the book to give you the money you need to get it written, translated, et cetera.
Yeah. So it sold about $150,000 worth of books. And that's enough for me to start working on other stuff. And that's that demand is coming from kind of the early demand, the people who are most excited about it. And then eventually it's going to get into Amazon and Barnes and Noble and that sort of thing. But it's kind of tapping into that early excitement and demand for the book and monetizing that a little bit more than you would through Amazon.
Yeah. That's awesome. Thanks for sharing that. And maybe, like I said, there's probably a lot of people that are interested. I definitely was. So I want to dive into some of these subjects here. So you talked about one of the big things was like this economic value and framework of Bitcoin. And so, why is there value there in the first place? And of course, that's one of the big complaints or arguments that we might hear, which I'm sure that's why you tackled that. There's nothing backing it. It's just like fiat or whatever it may be, right? So we hear that all the time. Some people think I think Peter Schiff tweeted today that, only it has to be commodity money. Only commodities are money. So walk us through kind of this economic value framework that you said you kind of have, if you will.
Yeah, of course. So money is really, it's a really difficult subject to understand. Most people don't understand why money has any value and they haven't really thought deeply about it. So that's fine. But the thing that's really hard about money is that with other sort of assets, financial assets, they're almost always valued on their cash flow. And that's fairly easy to understand. So stocks or bonds or real estate, stocks have dividends, bonds have interest, and real estate has rental cash flow. And you could look at a house and say, well, why is this house worth $1 million? Well, it produces $70,000 of rent per year. So that justifies it a little bit. Whereas money doesn't produce cash flow. Gold doesn't produce cash flow. Bitcoin doesn't produce a cash flow. So why does something like gold have value? Well, the reason is money serves this other purpose in society and historically has always served these purposes, medium of exchange and store of value and unit of account. And through history, humans have valued certain goods for their attributes that make them good at these functions of money. And we really need money in a society because money is this incredibly important economic good that facilitates social coordination.
Right.
If we don't have money, then we don't have a division of labor. And if we don't have a division of labor, we have a primitive society. We don't have civilization. We have a barter-based society where people are trading, you know, sheep for bread or whatever. And that right. really limits the scope in which trade can occur. So money is this fundamental innovation that society needs for civilization. So what are the attributes that make for a good money? These attributes have been known for a long time, all the way back to Aristotle, who wrote about these. Things like divisibility. You want to be able to divide the money that you have into small pieces to use in trade. Verifiability. It should be easy to recognize that this is money and it's not easy to fake it. Fungibility is another one. You want something which is essentially equivalent to any other piece or quantity of that thing. So gold is better as money than diamonds because diamonds are irregular in shape and quality. So they're not as good for trading. And probably the most important one of all of the attributes that make for good money is scarcity. You want to keep your savings in something that is very difficult to produce. If it's easy to produce, then your savings are going to be sort of diminished very quickly over time. So gold is much better as money than sand, because if sand were money, you could take a bucket to the beach and you'd be rich, right? So other people are not going to want to keep their savings in it, but gold is very difficult to produce.
Right.
So if you look at those attributes that make for a good monetary good, gold does really well over those attributes. And if you rank them, Bitcoin does even better. And one of the attributes I failed to mention was portability. Bitcoin is so much more portable than gold. I can transmit Bitcoin that I have to someone on the other end of the world almost instantly at very low cost. But if you were going to do that with gold, it'd be very expensive. It would be risky. If we rank monetary goods along these attributes that we know people demand for money, Bitcoin comes out really, really well. It's superior to gold along almost every attribute except for established history. Gold has this very long established history. And I think Bitcoin is actually superior to fiat monies along every single one of these attributes. And in my article, I have a table where I list all of the attributes and I rank them as if they're, you know, taking a test in college, A, B, C, D, E, F, and I rank all of them. Yeah. And you can go check out my article and see this ranking. Bitcoin, I think, is superior to fiat over all of the attributes. And it's that's the reason that Bitcoin outcompetes these other monetary goods over time, because people slowly recognize that Bitcoin has attributes that they want in money and that they need in money. And so they choose to keep their savings in Bitcoin rather than these forms of money. And I think the thing is understanding information can be transmitted very quickly around the world, but understanding takes time. And so I view this as like a process of the understanding of Bitcoin's superiority spreading around the world, but inevitably growing, which is why Bitcoin's adoption is also growing, because people are coming to this understanding and realizing, hey, it makes sense for me to keep some of my savings in Bitcoin.
Yeah. When you talk about the scarcity aspect and how gold's been really good at that, you know, one thing that I've always thought is I was a gold bug after 2008, after that market crashed. I then found I became actually a sound money advocate. But, you know, with gold, it was always kind of like money has to have a true cost of capital. So like you can't just create it from thin air. It must represent some form of energy. And so with gold, for example, I have to buy the land and buy the equipment and expend all the energy to get that gold. So there's like a true cost of that capital. And so it's backed by energy, right? And so you can like look at Bitcoin kind of the same way in a sense where it's also backed by capital because of the equipment and the energy that's used. So sometimes I've thought, well, it's backed the same as gold is backed, right? They're both backed by energy. Is that a good way to look at it?
I think you're absolutely correct. And that's the way Bitcoins are produced in this process of mining where the miners are running software, which has to expend real energy to produce a new Bitcoin. So, and you can actually look at the real cost. It's perfectly measurable. Unlike gold, it's not always clear how much energy went into the production of gold. It's very clear how much energy was expended to go into a Bitcoin. So there is a cost of capital. And so that means that when people have a Bitcoin, they know that a real amount of energy was put into its production and that it's an incredibly large amount of energy. Yeah. And that energy is what actually secures the Bitcoin network, which makes it hard for people to fake transactions and to create fake Bitcoins, because to create a new Bitcoin or to do a transaction, a huge amount of energy has to go into that. And that's what protects the integrity of Bitcoin's network.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. And then I guess the last piece would just be back to the commodity money, right? So then, of course, back to Schiff. Not to bring him up, but you know, well, gold has intrinsic value. I can use it as cufflinks, right? I like to say that there's no such thing as intrinsic value, and all value is you know, based off of what we decide it's worth. What would you say in regards to that, right? So gold is something physical. There's actually physical value there.
Yeah, so people get sort of caught up in the physicality of gold and the so-called term of intrinsic value to justify gold's price. I think that's actually quite a big mistake, because if you look at any form of money, its price level is determined by two factors. One is its utility, its kind of industrial use or whatever, or it's used for jewelry. And the other part is the monetary premium. That is, people aren't using it for its industrial use. They're using it for its monetary role. They're using it as a store of value or a medium of exchange. And a lot of the gold in the world, actually the majority of gold in the world, doesn't do anything. All it does is sit in vaults in banks and central banks around the world. And that demand is the monetary premium. And in my article, I explain that different monetary goods have different monetary premiums. If you look at silver, it has a fairly small monetary premium. Most of the price level of silver comes from its industrial use. Some people hold silver in vaults, but not many. Gold is mostly monetary premium. There are some industrial uses, but they're actually quite small compared to the amount of demand that comes from just having your gold sit there and do absolutely nothing. Bitcoin is pure monetary premium. It's a pure form of money. Now, the mistake is that people say that tiny amount of industrial demand for gold is the reason it has any value. No, it's completely wrong. The majority of gold's demand comes from its monetary uses.
Yeah.
And actually, if gold were to stop having any industrial uses and people decided, well, this isn't really nice for jewelry anymore, there's something better that we can create more cheaply, gold would still have a high price. Or another way of saying it, if you took away gold's monetary demand, its price level wouldn't be, you know, $1,700 an ounce. It would probably be $100 an ounce. So most of that value comes from the monetary side. And Peter Schiff kind of misses that. And he focuses on this tiny fraction of demand for gold. And he thinks that's the explanation for the price level of gold. No, money is valued for its monetary uses. And Bitcoin being a pure form of money has all of its value determined by that. And the last point I want to make about this is it's actually a big disadvantage for a monetary good to have industrial demand. The more industrial demand it has as a fraction of its price level, the worse it is as money, because you don't want the price level of your money to fluctuate all over the place if the industrial demand moves around. Like one year, there might be less demand. One year, there might be more demand. You don't want monies to behave that way. You want most of the value to be in that monetary premium.
Yeah. I think also on top of that, we don't necessarily want those materials to go up in price either, because they need to be used. And so if I'm putting all my money into real estate because dollars is no good, well, then it's pushing the price of real estate up and now nobody can afford a home. Or I'm putting it all into gold, but now it pushes the price of gold up and now we can't use it for conducting, which is what it should be used for example. So there's actually maybe a case for why non-commodity money is actually superior or better for society anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Right. That's a good point that I hadn't mentioned. It works in both directions. Yeah.
Hey, sorry to interrupt this video just one more time. I'm not running Google ads, so it's actually way less interruption than I normally would have on a video. And that's because it's sponsored by BlockFi. They are opening up the world of Bitcoin and financial products, offering to pay you interest on your Bitcoin, better than owning a rental property that you have to manage and control and have the risks. You can just earn interest on it, or you can leverage against it. Now, I plan to hold my Bitcoin forever and literally never sell my Bitcoin. So how do you do that? Well, if I need money, I don't want to sell that Bitcoin. I'm going to pay tax on it. All right. I'm going to end up with less and I don't have the Bitcoin anymore. So a better way to do it is to borrow against the Bitcoin. So I've put all my money into Bitcoin. If I want to buy a car or I want to buy a house, I can borrow against it at very, very low competitive rates, get my house, get my car, whatever that may be, and get to keep the Bitcoin. Now, I've done a whole video on this. You can find it. I'll link it down in the description below, how to retire off of Bitcoin without paying taxes. And you can do that with BlockFi services. I'll link to the video down below. I'm also going to put a link to BlockFi. If you choose to click on that link to check them out, you can earn up to $250 in free Bitcoin just for using that link. And that's it. Let's go ahead and get back to the interview. Yeah. If we jump to a different topic or something else that you had said that I think is also pretty important is that Bitcoin is old technology. I hear that one all the time, right? It's old technology. It's slow. It's dumb. It's the MySpace, the Facebook's coming, blah, blah, blah. But to your kind of point you made earlier, it had been tried for decades without succeeding. So this was not the first iteration. It has many generations. Maybe walk us through kind of that. Being a Google software engineer, maybe you can explain to us how technology kind of evolves and why maybe being a slow, dumb base layer is actually the best option.
Yeah, so Bitcoin is this fundamental innovation in computer science. It solved a problem in computer science that a lot of people didn't think was solvable, which is, it's called the Byzantine Generals problem. And Satoshi Nakamoto, when he published his paper in 2008, presented the first solution. And so he made something possible that had never been possible in the history of the world, which is to be able to transmit value from one end of the globe to the other end of the globe near instantly without having to have someone in between, a trusted intermediary like a government or a bank. And that's a profound innovation. The other part of your question is, well, other people can create these new cryptocurrencies. The thing is, these new cryptocurrencies aren't that they add technological bells and whistles, but they're not a fundamental innovation on top of Bitcoin. So the thing is here, Bitcoin is a monetary good and it's valued as a monetary good. For these new ones to outcompete Bitcoin, they have to improve on the monetary attributes that Bitcoin has. And none of them, as far as I can see, have any superior monetary attributes to Bitcoin, for instance, scarcity. And whenever you have something, any product or service or good that has a network effect, it's really, really hard to unseat that unless you are orders of magnitude better. The example of Facebook and MySpace is an interesting one. I think the only case in which something with a network effect can be outcompeted is in the very, very early stages. You know, when MySpace was still very young, when Facebook started competing with it, and Facebook was superior and managed to, you know, outcompete MySpace over the network effect, but it was early enough that that was possible. And I would say, actually, you know, Bitcoin could have been outcompeted if something much better had come along in 2012 or 13 when it was still early. But Bitcoin is so massive now, has such a strong network effect. And this encompasses many things. That encompasses the brand. It's the strongest brand by far. No altcoin is ever mentioned except in the context of Bitcoin. The financial infrastructure, all of the companies that provide on-ramps and off-ramps to Bitcoin and leverage on Bitcoin, most of these other altcoins don't have anything like that. The community of developers, the best cryptographers and computer scientists in the world are committed to working on Bitcoin. So there are a number of factors like that that add to Bitcoin's network effect. And it's at such a large scale now that I don't think it's possible for it to be outcompeted. And it's not about technology. It's not about adding like some cool new thing that sounds good on your altcoin. It's about, did you provide a better monetary attribute that's better than the ones that Bitcoin has? And I just looking at the attributes, I don't see how that's possible. There is one weakness. I think Bitcoin does have one weakness that I think will improve over time, is its fungibility. That is kind of the privacy aspect of Bitcoin. Like, is one Bitcoin equivalent to any other Bitcoin? And at the network layer, that is true. Any Bitcoin can be transmitted on the network like any other. But because Bitcoin's blockchain is open and transparent, it is possible to trace Bitcoins. And the disadvantage there is that a government could come along and say, well, this Bitcoin is tainted. We don't want any business to actually accept this Bitcoin. And they'll go to exchanges and say, here's the list of tainted Bitcoins. And that kind of reduces Bitcoin's fungibility a little bit. Cash, US dollars doesn't have this problem because it's completely anonymous and you can't tell where it came from. So this is one area which Bitcoin has a weakness, but I am actually very optimistic that this is going to improve over time through technological developments. And for instance, there's been a protocol upgrade to Bitcoin recently that's been approved by the network called Taproot, which is going to improve the privacy of Bitcoin. So, you know, if a new altcoin comes along and it's competing with Bitcoin, we shouldn't look at the technology. We should look at the monetary attributes. And Bitcoin only has, in my opinion, one weakness. And I think that is an area that's improving quickly over time.
Yeah, that's a good point to bring up on that weakness. It's something that I've actually had to, I've come under kind of quite a bit of fire on recently. As a matter of fact, I got invited and I accepted opportunity to go onto the Monero talk show to discuss this exact topic with Monero people. I was more than happy to do that. You know, in regards to that privacy problem, I mean, we do have layer two technologies like Lightning, which allow you to transact the Bitcoin much more private. We also have CoinJoin applications where we can kind of obfuscate, if not, you know, kind of erase that history as well. So I think in that regard, you have that, you know, their argument is, well, you know, Monero never had it in the first place. But it seems like if a merchant, so as you said, like it's not done on the network level. The network doesn't know the difference. It'd be a merchant that would be squeezed by the, you know, whatever regulators to not accept that Bitcoin. And so if they could accept a Monero or whatever privacy coin you want to use that has no history, then why wouldn't they just accept a Bitcoin that doesn't have a history? I mean, that's kind of the question that I kind of keep going back to.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think it's not a question without trade-offs, and people who say Monero or Zcash have more privacy need to accept that there are trade-offs. And this is actually a really difficult question. And the trade-off is, if you have perfect privacy, you lose some ability to have auditability in the supply. And Zcash, actually, they found a bug in the way they had these shielded transactions. They found a bug where they weren't properly accounting for supply and there was more supply than they thought. One of the great things about Bitcoin's blockchain being completely open is that we can audit and know how much supply has been created and verify that it's, you know, according to schedule. We know that no more than 21 million Bitcoins will ever be produced. So this is a technically difficult problem and there are trade-offs and we shouldn't sort of be too blasé about those trade-offs. I think some people, when they talk about this, they're like, oh yeah, this is easy, just use a different privacy coin. But you have to recognize that there are weaknesses that come from making that trade-off as well.
Yeah. So as a software engineer, and I look at the way that Bitcoin is done, and so we have that base layer, but it seems like we're seeing pretty rapidly now new technologies being built on layer two. And then now there's layer three that we have being started as well. And so it seems like we kind of have this base layer that gives you that hard, censorship resistant, decentralized, open, but then all the new technologies can be built on top, which then have those trade-offs that allow for those trade-offs. And it almost seems like all the other altcoins that are out there that have all these bells and whistles will all probably eventually come back and be on the main chain. As a software engineer, what do you think about that?
Yeah, that's a great point. And you mentioned something earlier that I forgot to mention, I think is really important, that Lightning is a privacy improving technology. It's a second layer on top of Bitcoin where people can trade Bitcoins back and forth very quickly and very cheaply. The base layer of Bitcoin is more costly and isn't really meant for transactional use. I mean, people got confused in the early days because there wasn't much usage and they thought, oh, Bitcoin's a payment system, a cheap payment system. But actually, it's a settlement layer. It's really meant for settlement, large settlement between large financial institutions or large holders of Bitcoin who want to send, you know, $1 million or something like that. The smaller transactions should happen on higher layers. And this was actually anticipated from the very beginning. Hal Finney, who's one of the people who helped develop Bitcoin in the very earliest days, he recognized that all financial systems are built in layers. And that's exactly how Bitcoin is being built. And I like what you said about how this is going to suck in, these extra layers are going to suck in the features from these other altcoins. It's kind of like, you know, to give an analogy, it's kind of like how cell phones sucked in all of these other features from all of these sort of peripheral products. Like think about the camera. In the early 2000s, people had separate digital cameras that they took pictures of. No one has that anymore. People used to buy GPSs. You remember the TomToms that you'd attach to your car? Yeah. People don't have that. All of these other things were sucked into the smartphone. And I think that's a really great way. I hadn't thought about it. A really great way of thinking about it is that these extra layers are going to pull in the feature set because it can be done much more cheaply and economically at the higher layers. And so that comparative advantage that people claim altcoins have is all going to be brought into Bitcoin.
Yeah. And we even have now smart contracts being done on Bitcoin. So why would you want to do a smart contract on a chain that's unsecure, right? Or centralized on Amazon servers, for example, when you could run smart contracts on Bitcoin. So it seems like that's the way that it's going. And if you can do smart contracts and faster and cheaper and more private, then those 8,000 other coins don't seem to have a whole lot of advantages that are kind of left over. The other thing is understanding how progress is made. I've been reading Hayek's book, The Constitution of Liberty, and he's talking about this concept of progress. And the more people that you can get in and the more iterations and attempts you can have, the faster that can happen, the more progress that can happen. And so then like on a very slow, dumb base layer, if you want to call Bitcoin that, it allows almost unlimited options on top of that, which means innovation could happen really fast. When you take a smarter, we'll call it that, whatever, a more featured blockchain, it limits the ability of things that you can build on top of it.
Yeah, I think this is a game where there are trade-offs where Ethereum tried to pack all of this functionality into the base layer. And the trade-off is that it becomes so complex that it really hinders the decentralization. That's the big trade-off. Like if you want to run your own Ethereum node, it's pretty costly and it's slow and it's hard. It is actually pretty hard to, people have tried this and they've written their experience about how difficult this is. And also like you really want that base layer, the settlement layer to be simple and accountable and really, really secure because that's where the majority of value transfer is going to happen. And I think it's something that most other altcoins haven't appreciated. And when they were put to the test, if they were put to the test, they failed. So Ethereum is an example where you want to trust the base layer. You don't want people to be able to, you know, governments to be able to come along and say, no, we don't like this transaction. We're going to roll it back. Yeah. And that actually happened on Ethereum in the early days when Ethereum faced its most important test. It failed, which is this DAO hack where people invested a bunch of money in this smart contract and it kind of failed. It wasn't programmed properly. Vitalik Buterin came along and got the miners to roll it back. So if you're on Ethereum and you have value and you want to transact a large amount, you can't necessarily trust that that's going to that transaction can't be rolled back. Whereas Bitcoin, you have a very high degree of trust that you can't roll back those transactions. And even if a nation state came along and said, look, we don't want Bitcoin to have this transaction, we're going to pressure some developers and miners, it's very hard because of Bitcoin's decentralization to do anything like that.
Yeah. And then more recently, one of the big things that Bitcoin had, back to your monetary principles, is scarcity. And so Ethereum has an unlimited supply cap. And was it 2 months ago or so, Vitalik and boys got together and they decided to give it a fixed monetary supply. But the fact that a group of people can get together and change the monetary supply of the network is exactly the problem we're trying to get away from. It sounds like the fiat money system.
Absolutely right. It's not the supply schedule that matters. It's the credibility of the supply schedule. Do you actually believe that Ethereum has a limited supply, or could it be changed? So gold has an inflation that goes forever. I mean, 2% is added to the supply of gold. But the thing about gold's supply schedule was we really trust it. We really believe that it isn't going to explode. Bitcoin has an even better supply schedule. It's ultimate scarcity. No more than 21 million Bitcoins will ever be produced. And the good thing about Bitcoin, as opposed to its competitors, is that we trust that supply schedule. We know because it's decentralized, no one can come along and change it. And that's incredibly important. And that's one of the biggest, I think, comparative advantages of Bitcoin over all of its competitors that none of its competitors have.
Yeah. Yeah. I look at it. I worked on this new thesis I've been presenting on these three revolutionary cycles that are converging. And so there's like a political, social, cultural, converging with a technological, and converging with a financial. And like, problem or solutions come to problems. So if you look at like the problems we have in like political, social, cultural, like we have obviously unlimited money printing, we have censorship. But one of the big problems we have is like we should be ruled by law, but now we're ruled by men. So the Constitution was supposed to limit the power and everybody knew what those rules were in advance and we could all plan our lives. But today we have men that just change the rules on us all the time. No, you can't eat inside anymore. Okay, now you can't eat outside. Okay, now if you put plexiglass up at 30%, okay, now it's 70%. It's like we can't do that. And so if you understand what the problems are, then the solutions would be censorship resistant, immutable law, right? Not governance, censorship, you know, all these things. And then when you understand the problems and solutions, I mean, it very quickly narrows it down to like only one option for that. So I love the way that you've put all this together. As you said, there's a lot of other good books. You mentioned Layered Money, and of course, Nick's book on that is great. There's so much good information. You said earlier, you know, you kind of put this together to relay information in a good, smooth way. And I think that's so important today. And so I'm encouraged by it, and hopefully other people are. I think that the ideas, good ideas win because they're good ideas. And if you can, share that information in the right way, then it wins. Right now, we kind of have this problem. We don't need to dive in too much, but you know, toxic stuff in the space where it's kind of like this cancel culture where it's like have fun staying poor kind of a thing. And it's like there could be a really good response that was given intelligently that could actually change that person's mind as opposed to kind of pushing them back and maybe digging their heels in even more.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what you say about truth prevailing. There's actually a Latin phrase, I'm trying to remember it. It's something like magna est veritas et prevalebit, which means truth is great and it will prevail. And I agree with that, because if you present people with the truth and you give them the reasons so that they can reason about it themselves, it's almost inevitable, because when you talk to someone or when you present a book to them, for instance, and they're reading your book, you're rewiring their brain. They're processing the information that you present. And if it makes sense and you provide the correct reasons, you are rewiring their brain to recognize something as truth, which is why I think we have an advantage when we present true ideas, when we present them compellingly and simply. People want to accept them and they see their importance. And that's been my experience talking about Bitcoin with people, that when these ideas are presented simply, people get really excited about them.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, we're going to go ahead and wrap it up with that. I know you got to get going, and I appreciate you sharing that. We'll make sure to link to, I guess, I don't know what we're linking to. Your book's not available yet, but where should people follow you? Twitter, I guess, is probably the best
Twitter, place. Yeah, you follow me at Twitter. That's the best place. I'll keep updating people on Twitter about when the book will be in stores. I'm hoping it's within a month. My Kickstarter campaign has ended, and I want to get the books out to the people who supported me, and then I want to get them out in stores so the wider population can get them. But yeah, Twitter, I'm real_VJ at Twitter.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. Well, with that, we'll go ahead and sign off. Thanks so much for joining.
Thanks, man.
All right.